MacCast, Sunday, October 8th, 2017. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to another episode of the MacCast. I hope your week, weekend, whatever it might be, has been going well for you. It's been quite busy around here at MacCast headquarters, but happy to be sitting down and going over the latest in Apple news and information with you. Also, getting into some of your questions and comments. And boy, do we have some cool stuff to talk about this week. We're going to talk a little bit about Apple Music, some new information about the number of subscribers they have, and sort of the direction Apple is taking with Apple Music, maybe a little bit different than you might think. We're also going to talk about possible ARM-based Macs. That has come up in the news again. Also, some acquisitions Apple has made in the AI area, rather. And also, possible issues with some of those new iPhone 8s, although it's probably more of an issue in the media than it is actually in real life. We'll explain all of that and talk a little bit more about iPhone 10, which is coming up here at the end of the month, the release of it, at least pre-orders, and how many of those are going to be around and available for us to possibly purchase and what demand is going to be like. And then I have a couple of iOS and macOS High Sierra updates to tell you about. And then we're going to get into some of your feedback. I have confirmation that my iPhone issues are also, unfortunately, some of your iPhone issues. We're going to get into some of your questions surrounding some of the new features of the new operating systems, getting into a little bit of Apple's new codecs. We're also going to dive into the new file system a little bit. I've been receiving a lot of questions from you about both of those things, so we're going to get into that. Also, Rick has some questions about how to prepare for upgrading to macOS High Sierra, specifically in cleaning up his system and sort of clearing out the cruft. So I'll give you some tips related to that. Also some additional iOS 11 and Safari tips. And I'm going to get into some of my still complaints about Apple Pay. And that's just triggering off actually a comment I received from a listener. So like I said, lots of things to get into and talk about. But before we get started, I do want to take a quick moment and mention one of our show sponsors, and that is Jamf Now. This episode is brought to you by Jamf Now. Jamf Now helps you manage your Apple devices from anywhere. When you first start your business, it's pretty easy to keep track of your own computer and your own phone. But when you start to grow, you add more employees, you buy more technology for those employees, it gets a little bit harder to keep track of everyone's Macs, iPhones, and iPads. Managing those things becomes difficult. And figuring out exactly how to secure that iPad that your sales rep lost, that can be tough, especially when you've got employees in different locations, maybe all over the world. And Jamf Now makes that and a lot more, much easier. You can basically configure settings, protect sensitive information, even lock or wipe a device remotely from anywhere using Jamf Now. Jamf Now secures your stuff so you can focus on your business. You need no IT experience is needed whatsoever. It's a great piece of software for managing multiple devices and computers, keeping all of that secure. And you can start securing your business today by setting up your first 3 devices for free, and you can add more devices for just $2 a month per device. Create your free account today at jamf.com/maccast. That's jamf.com/maccast. And a big thank you to Jamf Now for their support of the show. Apple Music now has 30 million subscribers, 30 million paid subscribers. That number is up from the 27 million that Apple told us about back in June at Worldwide Developer Conference. These new numbers come from a Billboard interview with a number of Apple Music executives, including Jimmy Iovine. They say that growth has been good, but Iovine thinks that Apple needs to do more to actually stay relevant in the current sort of streaming culture that we have going surrounding music. He said Apple's been great at adding back catalog stuff and keeping up with new hits and exclusives, but that's probably not going to be enough given that we live in an age where a lot of stuff is on YouTube for free. So they see YouTube as kind of a competition for them because it's a free service and you can get a lot of your music there. And a lot of younger folks do exactly that. And so what Apple is doing, according to the article, is seeing their position in music as not just providing an outlet for music streaming and back catalog and all that stuff, although that is the core of the business. They see it more as helping artists create things like exclusive content, short films, videos, radio shows that they can produce on the Beats One network. And all of that will help keep, in general, the music industry and, more importantly, the artists healthy and making money. And really, Apple sees Apple Music as a way to convert listeners into fans of new artists and things like that. So they're really trying to form relationships with the artists. That was kind of the sense I got from this article. And I know personally that thanks to Apple Music, I am actually finding and discovering more new artists and more new music. I'm not sure I've been converted into a fan of any of the new artists I've discovered yet, but I am digging in deeper. And so I think some of the things that Apple is doing in this area, I think they are working. The music industry saw about a 17% jump in revenue in the U.S. From the recorded music business in the first half of 2017. A lot of that actually thanks to streaming services like Apple Music and Spotify. And Goldman Sachs is estimating that subscription streaming will actually drive the global record business to nearly triple their revenue up to $41 billion by 2030. And obviously, Apple wants to be a big part of that. Something also I just want to point out that I'm enjoying with Apple Music is the new Friends feature. If you haven't had a chance to try that out and you are an Apple Music subscriber, it's new in the For You section. If you go into your account, you can now follow friends and see what they're listening to. And that's actually really helping me with my personal music discovery. So I'm kind of enjoying that. But overall, Apple Music is growing. Yes, they're not at the same numbers as the 60 million paid subscribers that Spotify has. And that gets brought up every time Apple Music announces kind of new numbers. And it irks me a little bit because I think that it's really not a competition. I think there's room for multiple streaming services. I like the fact that there is options and alternatives. For me, and I think for a lot of people, Apple Music makes sense. I'm fully invested in the Apple Music ecosystem, and it just works on all my devices. And I've actually tried Spotify in the past. It didn't really click for me, and Apple Music is working. But it's great to know that there are alternatives. And I think internally at Apple, they're not really feeling like it is a competition. I think they're really trying to sort of set themselves up with their own model and their own business, and it's working. The services business is growing in revenue. I think it now represents the second largest revenue stream for Apple behind the iPhone. So whatever they're doing, it's working out. They're adding new subscribers, they're creating new content, they're forming great relationships with artists and helping artists be more creative and have an outlet for that creative stuff through Apple Music. So I think overall this is a good thing, and a great little article over at Billboard. So if you want to read that interview, check it out. There's some really interesting stuff. If you're into music, if you want to know what's going on with Apple Music, it's worth giving that a read. We're starting to hear back again that Apple is looking at possibly bringing out Macs based on ARM processors. This is something that has been talked about for years now. It's surfaced from time to time. This time around, the subject has kind of been given new life thanks to a Nikkei report that claims Apple wants to make, quote, core processors for notebooks, modem chips for iPhones, and chips that integrate touch, fingerprint, and display driver functions. We know that Apple has been very interested in developing their own custom silicon for different kinds of processors. We've got the iPhone, the latest batches of iPhone, which I think just about every processor in there other than the modem chips is custom designed by Apple. The image processors in there, the GPUs, the CPUs, and when you get into the headphones, the W1 chips, which are in the AirPods doing wireless protocols. So yeah, Apple wants to do more with that, and supposedly they're investing heavily in research and development for broadband modem chips. So they're going to go after that part of the iPhone as well, at least according to this report. You know, they even have gone so far as to hire a former Qualcomm modem engineer. So we kind of have signs that this is something that they're really working on. And it makes sense, again, because they're also currently in a pretty big patent fight over cellular modem royalties with Qualcomm. They're not happy about the pricing they're having to, the prices they're having to pay for those royalties. Now, just developing their own chips may not get them out of those royalty requirements, but I think they want to further distance themselves away from Qualcomm, and I think they'd like to be in control of their own destiny. I think we've seen that over and over again. The report also says that that Apple would build its ARM Mac processors using a company, ARM Holdings, which is out of the UK, I believe, to actually produce and manufacture the chips, something that that company does. Now, this is, again, a tactic Apple has taken with the iPhone, and it has worked out very well for them. It allows them to better integrate the new technologies in their hardware with their software, and it reaps huge benefits in terms of performance, in terms of energy efficiency, and why they wouldn't want to bring that over to the Mac. I can't see an argument against it. So again, a lot of people think this will never happen, it won't happen. I think it's definitely a possibility, and it's certainly something that it would make sense that Apple would be exploring. And I can actually see a kind of a couple scenarios playing out. First, maybe a secondary dedicated ARM processor for some of the functions. We already know they have a W1-like chip in the Touch Bar MacBook Pros that drives the Touch Bar display and those sorts of things. So, you know, some of these other functionalities, integrated touch, fingerprint, and display drivers, it makes sense that Apple wants to do their own silicon in that area. And so they could have secondary ARM processors in the Macs to do those sorts of things. I could also see them doing an ARM-based Mac as kind of a dual processor system with some kind of intelligent switching in the software, so that when you're doing CPU functions that maybe don't need a higher-end processor, they could go with an Apple-designed ARM-based one that was maybe more energy efficient, very similar to what Apple currently does with their GPU technology, right? You have discrete GPUs, and then you have GPUs built into the CPUs, and it provides a nice way to get more battery life, especially out of notebooks and things like that. And then finally, they could just start with releasing an ARM-based model of, say, like a MacBook. Some of the entry-level models could use ARM-based processors. And keep in mind that we've had reports, benchmarking reports, that Apple's A11 chips are already beating out some of the Intel laptop chips, at least in terms of raw benchmarks. Now, you know, personally, I think that, you know, you can't really compare the two because they're not both running the same OS, but it's conceivable that you could get very high performance out of an Apple ARM chip, even in a desktop or a notebook. And as a matter of fact, Apple this past week released ARM-ready source code for the Xnu kernels found in iOS and macOS. So they have some development going on. Now, that doesn't necessarily point to or isn't necessarily a sign that, yes, Apple is actually working on ARM-based Macs, but it does kind of give this little indication that, hey, they've got the operating systems already kind of supporting this stuff. It's not that big of a leap for them to make the next step, and I think they actually will at some point. Now, one potential roadblock could be Apple's boot camp technology, because that would presumably not be ready for ARM-based Macs, but it, in fact, Microsoft is working on an ARM-compatible version of Windows, so that may not be a roadblock in the near future as well. So I think this is a thing where it's only a matter of when, not a matter of if Apple is going to do it. Will it happen in the next year? We'll have to wait and see. I think it could. I think maybe, though, we're about 2 or 3 years off from seeing an ARM-based Mac. Apple has acquired a French-based artificial intelligence startup, according to TechCrunch. Apple has reportedly acquired Regained, a French company focused on using artificial intelligence technology for photo and facial analysis. The company claims to focus on not just finding and recognizing the content inside an image, but also being able to assess the image's technical and aesthetic values. For faces, they also say that they can recognize things like gender, age, and emotion. The idea is to use sharpness, exposure, color, and other properties to better surface images, or actually just help you find the ones that you most likely want in a given, you know, when you're looking for something for a given use or a given context. It actually sounds like pretty cool technology, and I think there's many ways that Apple could actually leverage and integrate this into their what they're doing now, especially currently with photos, but also in other areas of the business. So things like memories could be made better, also better facial recognition and detection. Animoji, the new feature that is in the iPhone 10, of course, if they can look at and better recognize facial features and emotions, that would be really good. And this looks like really pretty cool stuff, especially the aesthetic values of photos. So you can go in and not just find photos that have a certain person in them or a certain object, but you can also actually look for photos based on aesthetic values or color. So, you know, show me all of the photos that I have that have a golden hue in the lighting, or show me all of the images that are blurry if you want to just simply quickly delete maybe some of your bad images. So you can find properties like that using this technology. So Apple doesn't comment, unfortunately, on these things other than to say that they do acquire other companies from time to time, but I fully expect to see this implemented pretty quickly. And I look forward to actually seeing this kind of technology make its way into the Photos application, both on Mac and iOS. So pretty cool stuff. What do you think? Do we have our first gate with the new iPhone 8 Plus? Let me tell you what's going on. A couple of photos surfaced this week, one in Taiwan and another in Japan, of some iPhone 8 Pluses that had bulging batteries. The batteries bulged up and actually were pushing out the screens in a couple models. These were new phones. They had been hooked up to only Apple official chargers, and Apple did confirm that they were legitimate and was actually looking into the incidents. Actually, a little bit later, a third image surfaced, this time in Hong Kong, and then Apple Insider also reported on four more people who said, hey, we have bulging batteries. In one case, the bulging battery even came right out of the box. So someone opened up their new phone and the screen was already separating. Now, luckily, it was only battery bulging, no fires, no injuries, no explosions. It was actually doing what it should do. There's actually a safety feature kind of built into batteries where lithium-ion batteries, where they are designed so that they can expand and not cause a problem. As to how widespread this is or what's exactly causing it, we don't really know. Apple, like I said, is looking into it. Right now, though, there's no indication that this is really a widespread issue. Seems like outside of maybe 6 to 7 reports, there haven't been any more. Typical failure rates on lithium-ion batteries are actually 1 in 1 million. So this really isn't a sign of anything out of the ordinary. The fact that these are getting reported, this has happened with other iPhone batteries at about the same rate. So this isn't systemic. It isn't epidemic, as some reports might want you to believe. But it is something that's going on, and it's great to hear that Apple is actually, you know, tracking it down, trying to look into it and seeing if it is a possible issue. And it's always a possibility that they just got a bad batch of batteries somewhere and they made their way into a few iPhones and that sort of thing happens. I also have another theory based on some tech support I got from an Apple retail store. I had an issue with actually one of my phones, and took it in to get it replaced. It was actually the same thing, a bulging battery. This one, though, on a old iPhone 5S. And when I took it in, they replaced it, no charge to me whatsoever, which was great and actually a welcome surprise. I was fully willing and prepared to pay for a new battery, but they went ahead and replaced it for me anyway. It actually gave me a brand new phone or a refurbished phone. But when they went to give it to me to exchange it, they said, hey, can you wait around for a bit because we want to charge it up and make sure that everything transfers over. And in the past, I remember most iPhones would come with a charged battery. And the genius explained to me, or the representative helping me out at the Apple Store explained to me that, yeah, because of the whole Samsung battery issue, they have changed the rules for how you are allowed to ship lithium ion batteries in electronics. And they now are shipped with a very low charge on them, just a minuscule charge. So often when they get to the retail store, they are not charged up at all, and so they need to charge them. And from what I understand or know of lithium ion batteries, especially when you're storing them, you are not supposed to store them with little or no charge in them, because that actually can lead to this issue of battery swelling. The chemistry basically starts to break down, and then it builds up gases, and then the batteries expand. At least that's what I've been told, and that's what I've come to understand over the years. If you happen to be a battery engineer and you know otherwise, please let us know. But I believe that is a thing. So it makes me wonder if Apple is producing a ton of iPhones, if these were maybe an early batch in maybe the first round, and those could have sat around in warehouses for several months. Who knows? Maybe the batteries drained completely and were just sitting there, and that is causing the issue. So while they may be trying to make things better by making this requirement, they actually could be making things a little bit worse. But who knows? But again, this doesn't seem to be a widespread issue. I don't think you need to be concerned if you have an iPhone, a new iPhone 8 or an iPhone 8 Plus. I think it's pretty isolated. And if it is a broader issue, I'm sure Apple will manage it and handle it through exchange or whatever it might be. Even often they will do warranty extension or warranty repair programs to kind of cover this sort of thing if it does turn out to be a just maybe bad batch of cells that they got. This is maybe not some great news if you're like me and you're holding out for a new iPhone X. Ming-Chi Kuo, one of our favorite analysts, has reduced his estimates for fall iPhone shipments from about 40 million units to between 30 to 35 million units. And that is not because he's expecting demand to be low. It's because he's thinking Apple is still having trouble with that true depth camera system, and they're not going to be able to necessarily produce enough units this year to meet demand. He does expect Apple to overcome the supply chain issues pretty quickly in 2018, so things should level out toward the beginning of next year. But what that means for you and me or anybody else who's looking to get an iPhone X, yeah, as we predicted, it is going to be pretty tricky to do. And it's not too surprising that true depth camera system, it's got a lot of sensors in there, it's got a lot of suppliers involved with it. It is a complex system, and they're working out new manufacturing techniques and things, I'm sure, for that. The plus side of that sensor, though, is that Ming-Chi Kuo also thinks that Apple has about a 2.5 year or up to a 2.5 year head start on facial recognition technology versus their competitors. So they're going to have a hard time catching up. I think best case scenario, he said Apple has a 1.5 year lead. So that's good news for Apple. And we're already seeing or hearing reports of the competitors wanting to jump into this space. I read a report this week that said some of them had been looking at the under the glass fingerprint technology that we had heard Apple was investigating for Touch ID. We've later come to know that Apple actually, Face ID was their number one technology for the phone, and the under-the-glass Touch ID or using additional Touch ID technology was actually plan B, not the other way around. So now more manufacturers are looking at moving toward a similar system to Face ID, but looks like they have some catch-up to do, no doubt. But regardless, demand for iPhone X is looking to be pretty big, and it looks like demand for the larger storage size is going to be higher. So Apple's going to release the iPhone X in two models, if you remember, a 64 gigabyte model and a 256 gigabyte model. RBC Capital Markets did a survey of potential new iPhone X customers, and they found that 57% said that they're planning to buy the larger sized model in terms of the storage. And I will certainly be in that camp. I'm a little bit actually upset with the breakdown, or just not upset. That's probably too strong a word. I'm a little bit puzzled by why Apple went with 64 gigabytes on the low end and then jumped all the way to 256 without kind of a middle tier. I kind of feel since they killed the middle tier storage size across the board, they should have gone with a 128. In the back of my mind, though, I know that flash storage has become a scarce commodity. So my guess is that Apple is doing that, eliminating that middle tier because of those shortages, that it's easier to come by some of the smaller modules, and to do those larger storage sizes is a little bit more difficult. So we kind of saw that across the lineup where it's 64 or 256. And seems like, at least with the iPhone X, more people are going to be going for the 256 option, which, again, when you're thinking about, hey, I'm going to order day one, yeah, you're going to be competing with everybody else for those larger sized models. Question I have for you, this actually came up, I think, on the Mac show when we were talking about this. If you're unable to get the 256 gigabyte model on order day and they still have 64s available, would you be willing to drop down your storage size to get it earlier, or would you wait a longer, possibly all the way into 2018, to get your new iPhone X? I think I would actually be in the latter camp. I don't see myself going for less storage. I probably could get away with less storage if I look at my current iPhone 7. It is right on that cusp, just under 64 gigabytes of data on that phone. And I just know with the dual camera system and the higher resolutions and taking more videos and pictures, I would quickly blow through that storage. So I always like to have a little bit of headroom, a little bit of future proofing, because my iPhones do get handed down through my family. So it's nice to be able to pass along something as, you know, storage needs increase, that's going to accommodate that. So I think I definitely would hold out. That same RBC Capital Markets report also asked what the iPhone X's most attractive feature was. And this was a little bit shocking to me. 46%, the vast majority of the people surveyed, said it was the wireless charging. I think the wireless charging is a great option. I just don't know if that's the quote unquote most attractive feature of the iPhone X, at least not for me. In second place was the facial recognition at 24%, and then third place, 14% said attractive design. Yes, attractive design, even with the notch, you notch haters out there. I actually don't really mind the notch too much. I don't think it's going to be that big of an issue, and I think it's something that's being overblown by a lot of people. I certainly respect someone's opinion and feeling that the notch is aesthetically distasteful to them, but is it a deal breaker? I don't think so. The one thing I was surprised about in this survey was that nobody said that the OLED screen was one of the most attractive features. I think it actually is. That display is going to be gorgeous with its high contrast and deep blacks. And also, for me, the number one most attractive feature of the new iPhone X is the updated cameras, the dual lens camera with dual optical image stabilization, the better telephoto lens. I think that is the number one reason a lot of people are actually going to be buying a new iPhone X, and you can count me in that group, because I've been wanting to get the dual lens camera system on a smaller form factor phone for a while, and the fact that I get a bigger screen at the same phone size that I currently have and the dual lens camera system with all of those portrait features, that's amazing. I'm really looking forward to that. And a number of you have asked, you know, is it worth upgrading if I already have an iPhone 7? And I would say, outside of just wanting to get the dual cameras, if you do have an iPhone 7 and not an iPhone 7 Plus, that may be enough to upgrade. But otherwise, I think This is a phone that you probably could skip over, wait a year, and just buy the next model, which is going to be even better and have even better features and might even come at a little lower price. The price point on the iPhone 10, again, I think I mentioned this last time, is something I'm still struggling with. I get that it's good for Apple's bottom line, but it does feel a little bit like a money grab. A number of people have pointed out that this was Apple's opportunity to kind of drive up the upper price point of the iPhone, and I think they absolutely did that. I think they're taking advantage, is that fair to say? Maybe. They are leveraging the fact that this is the 10th anniversary of the iPhone and using that as an opportunity to, you know, make a little bit more profit. And again, they're a for-profit company. I certainly personally don't fault them for that. I know it does upset some people out there. And I think, you know, $1,100, $1,200 for a phone is getting a bit crazy, but they're going to sell, you know, a gazillion of them. So who am I to fault them for wanting to make a buck? Quo also believes that iPhone 8 and 8 Plus sales are actually going better than expected. A lot of people thought that, hey, they're not going to do so well because people are going to hold out for the iPhone 10. It's not looking to be that way. There's a lot of people picking up the new iPhone 8 and 8 Plus. And based on that other survey, those both have wireless charging as well. So that may be the one feature that Apple added that is really helping drive up excitement around the iPhone 8 and 8 Plus and drive up those sales. So kudos on Apple if that is what is going on. And then finally in the news for this week, a couple of iOS and macOS High Sierra updates to tell you about. Apple did release iOS 11.0.2 just about a week after iOS 11.0.1 update came out. The .2 update addresses an issue with the iPhone 8 and 8 Plus that some people were experiencing where they would have crackling sounds in the earpiece during phone and FaceTime calls. So if you've been plagued by that, you certainly want to grab the iOS 11.0.2 update. Unfortunately for me and many others, it still hasn't seemed to address the rapid battery depletion issue that we're experiencing. I'm still at a point where I really can't get to the end of the day without having to plug my iPhone in at least once, and that wasn't the case before upgrading to iOS 11. Luckily, iOS 11.1 looks like it's just around the corner. It is in beta testing, although I'm hearing from some beta testers that that's not addressing the battery issue either. So, you know, it's still time for Apple to tweak that and slip that in there. Let's hope that that happens. But also, what looks like it might be coming in iOS 11.1 is Apple Pay Cash. That was something that Apple announced at Worldwide Developer Conference. That's the ability to do person-to-person payments through the Messages app with Apple Pay. And the feature was enabled internally, or is being enabled internally and supposedly tested by Apple employees. They've been given a device certificate and they've been testing it internally. Money is sent and received, as I mentioned, via a Messages app. And the funds are actually stored in an Apple Pay Cash card that appears in the wallet on your in the wallet app on your phone. And the money from your card can be transferred directly into your bank account. And you can connect it to a debit or a credit card for making transactions, although if you do Apple Pay Cash via a credit card transaction, you are going to incur a 3% fee. If you do it from a debit card, there is no fee. And the money that gets transferred, if you get a payment from someone onto your Apple Pay Cash card, can actually be used anywhere you can use Apple Pay. So you can use the money that's on that card at an Apple Pay terminal and take money out that way. So you have a couple different options for getting that in and out. I'm looking forward to actually using Apple Pay Cash. I think it's going to be a handy feature and great for those times when you're out and somebody wants to pay, say, for a bill with their credit card and everybody else needs to, you know, pay their or give them back their portion. The ability to just quickly send that through Apple Pay Cash, I think, is going to be a great feature. I was sorry to see that that actually didn't make it into the first release of iOS 11, but it looks like it will be coming here shortly, assuming, I guess, that the testing goes okay. And then lastly, High Sierra has a supplemental update out. So if you have upgraded to macOS High Sierra, you're definitely going to want to grab this one because it fixes a bug with encrypted Apple file system volumes. There was an issue where it was actually exposing your password via the password hint. Somehow those things had gotten flopped. So if you created an encrypted container on an APFS volume, you would enter the password, you would enter a password hint, and the password was getting stored in the password hint field in clear text. So when you mistype the password and the hint would come up, it would actually reveal your password. Yeah, definitely not good. That has been fixed with the High Sierra 10.13 supplemental update. So make sure you install that. And if you already had a volume encrypted before this update came out, you are going to have to do some things to reapply it. Apple has some instructions in a support article. Basically, you're going to have to backup, erase, and restore that APFS container on the volume. And I will link to how to do that in the show notes at maccast.com. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Something we talked about on the last episode of the MacCast was iOS 11. And one of the issues that I was having is this weird, I'm going to call it a wake from sleep issue for lack of a better term. But basically, if I press the side button on my phone to put my iPhone to sleep, occasionally, if I want to then go ahead and wake it back up when I press the side button again, the phone is completely unresponsive, or at least appears to be unresponsive. Nothing happens on the screen. I can press the home button, doesn't come up. The raise to wake doesn't work. And the phone is actually still on. It's just delayed in terms of the response. So I'll start to see, because I've pressed the side button a few times, it will flicker a little bit and then suddenly come back to life, maybe about 20 or 30 seconds after I've run into this issue. And I asked, you know, is this just me? Do I need to do a restore of my phone? And it looks like it's not just me. I got feedback from several of you, including Gary.
Hey, Adam, Gary. I wanted to quickly give you feedback on your flickering iPhone not responding issue. You're not alone. I'm right there with you. I don't know if other people are affected, but generally I pick up my phone and I look at it and I'm like, where's the screen? Or if I press the home button, I think you called it the sleep wake button, maybe the power button on the side, nothing happens. And I'm like, well, what's the issue here? Did I not press it? Is something going on? It's not, like you said, registering it. So usually I just set it down, pick it back up, nothing happens. Set it down, pick it back up, nothing happens. And I think you said it yourself, is like 30 seconds. So I just wait 30 seconds and it seems like it resolves itself. I don't know if it's internally thinking about it or what, but like the AI is thinking about something else inside there. But I have been experiencing the same issue. I just assume that things are going to get fixed as point updates come out. And I think there's actually a 11.0.1 that I'm possibly going to be trying later today. Maybe that'll help resolve that issue. But I wanted to let you know, you're not alone. Thanks.
Hey, thanks, Gary. It's nice to know that I'm not alone in this, although I wish we were all alone in this. How do I want to say that? I was hoping that nobody else was having this issue. Let's just put it that way. So sad to hear that you're having the issue. And I do know that many others of you have run into this problem. And Gary, you've probably already found this out, but iOS 11.0.1 didn't fix the issue. And also 11.0.2 has not resolved the issue for me as well. So I guess maybe we're going to have to hold out for iOS 11.1. But I'm sure Apple is aware of the issue by this point, and hopefully we'll have a fix for us soon. Big new feature of iOS 11 and actually macOS High Sierra is support for Apple's new image codec. And I guess it's technically not Apple's image codec and video codec. It's actually one based on the H.265 specification. And I'm talking about the HEIF, or High Efficiency Image File Format. And in the acronym, just so you know, there is only one F. I guess the file part, or maybe the format part, is silent or not represented. So it's HEIF, also HEVC, High Efficiency Video Codec, on the video side. But those are new features in the operating system. And I've been receiving a few questions from some of you about just how does this stuff work? What is it? Why are we making this switch? What's up with the move away from JPEG? And basically, the idea is that you can get a lot of new features and functionality with the new image format and save, more importantly, save on file sizes. So HEIF, for example, uses about half the storage of that a JPEG of similar size and quality would. So same resolution, same image quality, half the size. And in an age where, you know, we're getting flash storage that's maybe smaller than what we had in the past, that's ultimately a good thing. Some other advantages of the high efficiency image file format is that it's a container, actually, more so than just a file. So it can store other bits of information, including metadata, sequences of images. So live photos works really well in that format. You kind of have this GIF, animated GIF style thing built into it. It supports transparency, just like PNGs and GIFs do as well. So you can have transparent backgrounds. You can store 16-bit image color versus 8-bit image color, and it has extended color ranges. So more color depth, all those sorts of things. And EXIF, ICC, and XMP data is built into the file format as well. It's kind of a first-class citizen. It's not something that's actually bolted on. So it has lots of advantages. The question then becomes, how compatible is it? Am I going to have issues if I'm shooting HEIF files on my iPhone? Do I need to worry about anything? And overall, the answer is no, you're probably not going to have to worry about very much, because when you export or share HEIF files outside of Mac OS High Sierra or iOS 11, they get converted into standard JPEG files. Same sort of thing on the video side. The video codec, again, it's going to save space. It has a lot of advantages. One thing to note, though, is that if you are a Final Cut 10 user, it currently does not support the new codec, which is frustrating, but it will eventually. It will import HEVC files, but unfortunately they'll just appear as a black screen when you're playing them back in Final Cut 10. You will get the audio though. So you're going to have to convert those to a more standardized format. You can do that actually using the Photos application. So if you just bring the video into Photos and then export it out, it will export as a standard, say, MPEG-4 or H.264 file that you can then bring into Final Cut. Also note that when you're transferring images via AirDrop, it will convert them back into the JPEG file format, and that's even if you're going into Mac OS High Sierra. So if you're going from your iPhone to Mac OS High Sierra, be aware of that. If you want to keep them in their native HEIF format, you're going to want to do that through the USB cable and actually sync your photos over onto the Mac. You can also use Image Capture to transfer them directly. If you're using Photos in Sierra, Sierra will also support, at least Photos in Sierra will also support the HEIF format. Although we did run across a little bit of, I don't know if this is a bug or deliberate, but just sort of an odd thing with exporting HEIF files from Photos in Mac OS Sierra. This is not High Sierra, but Sierra. So if you have, say, an iPhone running iOS 11, an iPhone that supports the HEIF image format, and you're bringing those into a Mac that still hasn't been upgraded, you should be aware of this. What it looks like is that if you have an HEIF photo in Photos and you drag it out of the Photos application onto the desktop or into an email or something like that, it seems to change the resolution. So the native resolution would be 4,032 pixels by 3,024. Images that are drug out of the Photos application in Mac OS Sierra seem to come out as JPEGs at 2048 by 1536 pixels. So they are a reduced resolution for some reason. Now, if you just choose file and export from that same image, so select that image in Photos and actually export it that way, it does seem to maintain the full resolution. And again, this doesn't appear to be a problem in Mac OS High Sierra. So I wanted to point that out. A listener ran across that issue and we did a little bit of troubleshooting and figured it out, but I was able to confirm I had exactly the same problem. If you export them directly out of iOS, say into the Files application or into a Dropbox or something like that, they also will come out as JPEGs at the full resolution. So just something to be aware of. If you are running an iPhone and you want to choose to not store your photos or take your photos in the new high efficiency image file format, you can actually change the settings in the camera settings. If you go into Settings, Camera, you'll notice a new option called Format. If you don't see that Format option, that means your iPhone doesn't support the new HEIF images. I think you need to have an iPhone 7 or later to support the new format in terms of capturing images in that. All devices that run iOS 11 will be able to actually read and view HEIF formatted images, however. So just be aware of that. But go into Settings, Camera, under Format if you want to change it, and you can change the option from High Efficiency to Most Compatible. And if you switch it back to Most Compatible, it's going to go back to shooting in standard JPEG file format. And then one other question I've been being asked is, you know, what about image editors and image editing tools and things like that? Are they going to support HEIF native file format? And the answer is you're going to have to probably check with the developer. It is a licensed technology, so it may take a little while for support to come. I know some of the more popular image editors, I think Pixelmator and some of those others, have come out with updates recently, and they are going to be supporting the new file format. Some applications that support may never come, but it might not be that big a deal because, again, the conversion happens automatically, I think, both on import and export. So if you have an older application and you're trying to bring in an HEIF formatted file, you can simply export it as JPEG before you bring it in, or the conversion might even automatically happen on import. I'm not really sure. But so far, I've been using HEIF with iOS 11 and Mac OS Sierra, and I have not noticed any issues. Stuff seems to be going back and forth just fine. I'm still able to save out and share images on social media and those sorts of things because they do get converted. I've sent images via email. Again, they get converted back to standard JPEG. So I think you're really not going to have to worry about it too much. Apple has done a pretty good job. But it is something to be aware of in case you do run into a snag, and that might be why you're having trouble with an image, something like that. So if you bring it into a program and suddenly it's doing weird stuff, you might just double check, oh, is this a HEIF image? Oh, and that was another thing to point out. The pronunciation of the acronym is HEIF, like beef with an H. So in case you were wondering how to pronounce that, that's how it's pronounced. We don't need to have a GIF controversy with this new image format. And so I hope that answers a lot of your immediate questions around HEIF and HEVC. I'm sure we're going to be talking more about those formats and some of the other features and tips and tricks related to it in future episodes. And if you happen to have anything to add, certainly shoot us an email, maccast@gmail.com. With Mac OS High Sierra out in the wild, the other thing that I'm being asked about a lot by you is questions about Apple File System, the new APFS file system. Specifically, how does it work with external drives and what is compatibility like with my older HFS Plus formatted volumes? I think we've already mentioned that if you have a solid state drive as your boot drive, when you upgrade to Mac OS High Sierra, it is going to be automatically converted to APFS. And that has brought up the question, probably the number one question that I've been being asked, which is, if I have an APFS formatted volume and I have files on that volume, am I going to be able to copy them off onto volumes that are not APFS? And the answer is absolutely. The files themselves are in a format that is really independent of the file system. The file system really is the structure. It generally only impacts the way documents are managed and stored on the drive. It's not going to do anything to manipulate or change the documents themselves. And, you know, that may seem obvious, but it really isn't. These things, feel in a lot of ways like they're tied together. But if you step back and you think about it, we've been able to take files from, say, a Windows volume, which is in a completely different file system, and bring those over to a Mac volume just fine, as long as the operating system can read and write the file format, right? So same thing for cloud storage. When you store something up in the cloud, a file up in the cloud, it could be on any operating system or any file system. You don't really know or need to care. It's the same kind of thing here. So you won't have any problems moving your files around, even if you have older HFS plus formatted volumes. You can take things back and forth just fine. Another question that I get asked is, what is being converted? We mentioned solid-state boot drives being converted by default. It is worth noting that you cannot opt out of that process. So if you have flash storage or an SSD as the main volume on your Mac, it's going to be automatically converted. You can also convert your external solid-state drives, but keep in mind that once those are converted, they're only going to be readable by systems running Mac OS Sierra or High Sierra. Now, Apple officially states that only High Sierra supports APFS formatted volumes, but we're hearing in the community that Mac OS Sierra does seem to be able to read and write to APFS formatted volumes as well. Just be careful with that, again, because Apple is not officially supporting that. But outside of those two operating systems, if you have a drive that you take to older Macs, you probably do not want to convert it to APFS just yet. Keep it in HFS Plus. Your traditional spinning hard drives are also supported by APFS, although it doesn't gain really any advantages in converting it to that file format. A lot of the advantages of APFS are really only realized when you have solid state storage or a solid state drive. So why you would actually want to go back and convert any NTFS spinning drives that you have to APFS, who really knows? I think ultimately when Apple rolls APFS out completely, it is going to be the de facto standard, regardless of whether you have a spinning drive or a solid state drive. But for now, I don't see any real reason to rush out and convert your drives, at least nothing that I've read so far. If that situation changes, I will mention it on a future episode of the MacCast. If you have a Fusion drive, Fusion drives currently are not at all supported on APFS, although Apple is expected to bring that support sometime in the future. We don't know at that point if Apple will auto-convert Fusion or hybrid drives over to APFS. So we're just going to have to wait to find out on that one. Another thing to note if you do format your drive in APFS is that you cannot simply just convert that back to HFS Plus without reformatting. So if you are going to convert a drive, make sure that you back it up first. There shouldn't be any issues in converting it, but you never know. And if you decide you want to backtrack a little bit, you're going to be happy to have that backup. Another question that has come up is the subject of backup. If I'm doing backup, if I have an APFS formatted volume, am I going to be able to use my backup cloning software, things like Carbon Copy Cloner, Super Duper, Time Machine? I can tell you right up front, Time Machine is supported, although your Time Machine drives, again, cannot be APFS. They do have to remain HFS Plus, at least for now. It has to do with how the containers and things are handled with Time Machine. So Time Machine has not been updated to support APFS volumes yet. So keep your Time Machine drives formatted as they are in HFS Plus, but Time Machine should continue to work just fine. You'll be able to back up your APFS volumes to your Time Machine without issue, so you don't need to worry about that. As far as cloning software like Carbon Copy Cloner and Super Duper, both those companies are offering versions of their software that supports APFS. I think Super Duper, in the case of Super Duper, it's a beta release, so you're going to have to go grab the latest beta that adds APFS support. But it's worth noting that both of those companies say you probably, if you rely on their product for doing your backup, you probably want to hold off on upgrading, because Apple has left a number of features currently undocumented. So they've had to guess at some things. And I think we talked about this a little bit on the last episode of the MacCast with regards to Super Duper. They've had to guess at some things. They're waiting to get confirmation from Apple or further documentation from Apple. So you might want to hold off. It does seem to be working. I've talked to some people who are using Carbon Copy Cloner. I did have a handful of people say they're having little issues. So again, these are the kinds of bumps in the road if you're going to be an early adopter of a new operating system, especially one that has a big underlying change like this. You're going to hit some snags. So just be aware of that, and this might be a reason to hold off for a month or two before you upgrade to Mac OS High Sierra. Really, in High Sierra, a lot of the stuff is under the hood. You're not going to see a lot of big sweeping changes on the front end that are going to really impact your daily life. So, you know, the sort of need to upgrade, I think, is a little bit reduced. Ultimately, you want to get there, but I don't think you need to rush out day one. Again, we kind of asked, we answered the question a little bit, can I use HFS Plus and APFS volumes on the same Mac at the same time? Absolutely no problem. APFS should also work fine with most cloud-based services, although I would still check on those before you upgrade. So if you have one that you rely on, double check. I think from what I've heard, Dropbox is the big one, and that seems to be working just fine. I think OneDrive, Google Drive, all of those should be fine as well. But again, dig in a little bit deeper just to make sure. And then a little word of caution, be careful if you're planning on using encryption with your HFS Plus volumes after upgrading to Mac OS High Sierra. Apparently, there seems to be an issue when you select the volume, right-click on the volume, and choose encrypt. So this would be in the case where you have an HFS volume, you've upgraded to Mac OS High Sierra, and now you want to add encryption to that HFS volume. The way you would typically do that is you control or right-click on the icon in the Finder, and you'll see an option that says encrypt. Apparently, people have noticed in High Sierra, if you choose that encrypt option, it's converting the HFS Plus volume to APFS. So if you don't want to have the volume converted, you're not going to want to do that. Hopefully, Apple will fix disk utility or the formatter so that this doesn't happen. Nobody really knows why it's happening right now, but just something to be aware of and be careful of. If you've already converted an HFS Plus volume inadvertently to APFS because you enabled encryption in Mac OS High Sierra, unfortunately, the only fix for it is going to be to erase the drive and reformat it back to HFS Plus. So just, you know, you're going to want to pull a backup and revert using that process, which kind of stinks. And then a little other thing on encryption. It's been a little bit confusing because one of the big new features of APFS is that it supports encryption by default. But that doesn't mean that you should go in and disable File Vault if you are a File Vault user. Because what it really means is in APFS, encryption is just part of the file system. It's built into it, meaning that it's more efficient. It's less likely that you're going to run into any issues or that things are going to go wrong with the encryption, but you do still need to turn it on or quote unquote enable it as a feature. And doing that, it's simpler to enable, but you're still going to want to keep using File Vault. So turning File Vault on an APS volume, it gets that encryption that's sort of built into it, as opposed to being a layer on top of it, which is kind of how File Vault works with HFS Plus right now. So there's a little bit of a difference, but you still need to enable encryption as an option. Just because it's built in doesn't mean that it's quote unquote turned on by default. So something to be aware of in macOS High Sierra. But that's kind of some just updates and answering a few of your questions surrounding APFS. If you have additional questions, of course, send them along, macast@gmail.com. Or if you just have tips or tricks or information related to the new Apple file system, please also share those with us, macast@gmail.com. Rick was asking about sort of the steps in preparing for upgrading to macOS High Sierra. I know I kind of covered talking about, you know, doing backups before you run the installer and those sorts of things, but Rick was asking more about doing a little bit of house cleaning, kind of cleaning up before you upgrade. And I always think that's a good idea. You know, go through, find your old files, things that you really don't need on there as you're upgrading. It's a good time to kind of do some checking in and maybe do a little bit of spring cleaning. And Rick wanted to know what are some good tools for actually being able to do that, specifically going through and maybe finding large files and things that are worth clearing off to free up some storage space on his drives, which, you know, those things fill up so quickly. And if you're not paying attention, you can wind up with things that are like really old. I know I go through every once in a while and it's like, why is that still on there? I can archive that. I can get that off onto a Drobo or some other place. I don't need that stored immediately accessible on my main hard drive. And so, Rick, to kind of answer your question, one thing I like to do before upgrading is run Clean My Mac, which I think is just a great tool. Now, Clean My Mac, they're a sponsor of the MacCast, but I've been using the software long before they became a sponsor because it's just really great. It's a simple way to go through. It scans your whole system and makes recommendations for stuff that you can actually clean up, stuff like old system junk and cache files, mail attachments that can be re-downloaded. You don't need to have everything that you've ever, you know, that's ever come into your inbox as an email attachment stored locally, or clearing out some of your photo caches, or maybe your old music streaming caches from iTunes. Get rid of that stuff. You can clean that out. And what I really like about Clean My Mac is you can have it be automated, but I really prefer to have kind of a review. So I can have it scan and then I can go through and review the things that it's saying or recommending that I should clean out. And then I can make a decision. Do I really want to remove that stuff or am I okay with that being there? And that's really handy. And as part of the Clean My Mac software, it also does have a section called Large and Old Files. So it'll give you a list of everything that is, you know, a large file on your system, and it will also show you files that maybe you haven't accessed in a long time. So you can see those files that are still on your system from, you know, hey, this file's there and it hasn't been opened up in the last 5 years. You know, it's been 5 years since you opened this file. So maybe that's the kind of file you want to then drag off and put on an archive somewhere and store someplace else, not so immediate on your Mac. Another great app for finding and dealing with large files is Daisy Disk. It gives you kind of this nice graph, visual graph, to kind of show you where files are taking up large bits of storage and helps you drill down and manage those and clean those things up. You can find that in the Mac App Store or at daisydiskapp.com. And again, I'll have links in the show notes to all of these applications. And then lastly, and I almost forgot about this one when I was replying to Rick, macOS Sierra and macOS High Sierra now, they actually have a built-in large file scanner, a couple tools to help you find and manage your storage. If you go under your Apple menu, choose About This Mac, and then click on the Storage tab, you'll get a nice little graph that shows you the storage that's on your Mac and what's taking up storage. But then next to that, you will see a Manage button. If you click on Manage, it brings up another panel, and then on the left-hand side, you'll see an option called Documents. If you click on Documents in the sidebar, it will give you a view where there's three tabs, and you can view the large files that are in your documents. You can choose to view Downloads, which is basically the contents of your Downloads folder. So, you know, maybe things that you've downloaded from the web, and then you've installed them, but you've somehow left the downloaded file or the zip file behind. You'll find those there. And there's also then just a file browser that works a lot like the Finder, except that it has some columns where you can, again, you can sort by the last opened date to see if you have some old files in there, or also it lists out all of the file sizes and folder sizes for you. So you can help, it will help you identify, you know, where are my big, large files. And if you hover over or click on a document in there, I think along the bottom, You get the path to it, so you can see, you know, where it is in the system. You can also hover over an item, and you'll get a little magnifying glass icon. If you click on that, it will show you where that file is in the Finder, so you can go and manage it. Or just from the interface itself, you can also click on the little X icon when you hover over a file name, and that will give you the option to delete it after doing a confirm. Just be aware that when you delete that item, it is erasing it from your system. I'm not even sure that it goes into the trash. It might go into the trash and need to be emptied again, but I think it actually just gets directly deleted if you click that X and then confirm the deletion. So be careful with that. You know, anytime you're cleaning out files on your Mac, you know what I'm going to say. You should have a backup, and a backup that you know is working. Don't delete anything without first confirming that it's backed up, okay? Just a word of caution. And then, Rick, just one last thing to point out, and this one always, I always forget about it, and then when I do discover it again, I realize, wow, this is eating up a lot of my storage on the Mac. A big culprit is old iOS backups, and you can check for these in iTunes pretty easily. If you open up iTunes, go into the preferences, and then click on the devices tab, you'll get a list of all of your local iTunes backups right there, and they all have dates on them. So you can see when were those backups taken. It will list the device and which backup it's associated with, and sometimes you'll have multiple backups. I know this happens to me because I'll pull manual backups before I do certain things like restoring my iPhone, and a lot of those old backups you probably don't need anymore. So you can select any of those in the list, and you can click delete backup to remove those from your Mac. And those backups will tend to be whatever size your iPhone is. So like I said, I have a 128 gigabyte iPhone with about 64 gigabytes of storage on it. So each one of those backups for me is 64 gigabytes. And if I'm looking at my iPad, we're talking about, you know, 256 gigabytes or up to 256 gigabytes. So that is a lot of storage space being stored locally, especially if you have multiple old backups. So you can clear those out there. You can also look directly in the Finder. If you go into your home folder, the library folder under application support, there's a folder called Mobile Sync. And inside that, there's a backup folder. And that's where you'll see all of these backup files. Now, just be careful there because the folder names on there are just cryptic. It's like a hash. You're not really going to be able to tell which one is associated with which device backup. So I think it's much better to manage those from inside iTunes. It's a little more direct. But one thing I did discover in my case was I had some older iPhone backups or iOS backups that weren't showing up in the iTunes interface. So I cleaned some out from there, but be careful with that because I do think in some cases, older backups are kind of referenced or backups are split between multiple folders and things like that. So just be aware of that. And again, make sure you have backups before you do any direct deleting, at least in the Finder. But Rick, I hope that helps give you some software and some tools to help you clean up and optimize before you upgrade to macOS High Sierra. Now I want to give you a couple quick tips here, one for iOS and one for the Mac and Safari. I guess the second one's more just an observation of a new feature, but something that I think is really cool. Let me start off with the iOS 11 tip. Apparently in iOS 11 Maps, you can now do a one-finger zoom. So you no longer have to do the whole pinch to zoom thing. This could be handy if you're using your iPhone one-handed and you're needing to deal with maps. What you can now do is double tap the map, but on the second tap, don't lift your finger, just start sliding it up or down. And when you start to slide it up or down, it will do the zoom in, zoom out. Pretty cool. And a handy little tip, right? So I thought that was cool. And then for macOS High Sierra, or actually it's not just High Sierra, it's any Mac where you're running the updated Safari 11 browser, I wanted to point out that Apple has consolidated and made it much easier to manage your security and privacy all in one place. If you go into Safari's preferences in Safari 11, you'll notice a new tab called Websites. Click on that tab and you get this nice list of features on the left-hand side. Some of them security features, convenience features, things like your content blockers. If you have ad blockers installed, they're going to show up there. The option to stop auto-playing video ads on websites shows up there. And what's really cool about most of these settings is you can control them on a site-by-site basis. So when you click on anything on the left-hand side, what you get on the right-hand side is a list of websites that you visited and the options for those websites. So you can now do things like set the zoom level for a site on a site-by-site basis in Safari. You also get the controls for which websites you've authorized to access your EyeSight camera or have access to the mic on your Mac, so you can quickly review those security and privacy settings. Also, location and website notifications are in there, so if you've authorized a site to be able to use your GPS or your location, that will show up in here. And one of my favorite new features in Safari 11 is you can now set up the reader feature, which I absolutely love and I use all of the time in Safari. You can set it up to go into reader mode automatically for some of your favorite websites. So a lot of the news websites that I go to, I now have defaulted to just open up articles right into reader mode. So I no longer have to click the little three-line reader button up in the URL bar. It just happens automatically. And once again, in the website preferences area, you can set this on a site-by-site basis. So you could do it for just the sites that you want to and not for ones that you don't. And you can also set defaults for these for new websites. So as you hit new websites, you can set up defaults for all of these, again, in the websites section. So I really wanted to point this out. And this is also now where you would manage your plugins. So under that, under this section, there's a plugins section, and you can see all of the plugins that are installed for your web browser, and you can turn those plugins on and off using simple little checkboxes. So I thought that was pretty cool. And one last little tip for Safari 11, and I think this is new. I don't think I noticed this before, but one pet peeve that I've had with Safari is this feature where once you've typed in a URL, no matter how deep you go into a website, Safari only displays the top level domain in the URL bar, at least until you click on it. And then you can kind of get the full URL, but it basically masks or hides that full URL until you click on it. Well, now if you go into Safari preferences under advanced, I noticed there is a setting for the smart search field and a checkbox that says show full website addresses. And if you click that, then always up at the top in the URL bar, it is gonna show the full website address. So I've switched mine on because I prefer to see it that way. And I do think that is a new feature, but if I missed it before, it's still a great tip. And so there you go, a couple of iOS 11 and Safari tips for you. And then finally, in the show for today, I received an Apple Pay comment. You know, I've been a little bit critical of Apple Pay at retail. I'm a huge fan of Apple Pay. I think it is awesome. My complaint really is that I want to use it more. I want to be able to use it at more places. I want to be able to have the convenience of Apple Pay everywhere. And I'm just not getting that experience. And unfortunately, it seems like the experience at the register is getting a little bit worse, at least for me. And I keep hearing from more and more of you that you're having similar experiences. And something came up this week, and I got this comment from Eric, who is having some trouble with what appears to be a recent change in Apple Pay. So here's what Eric had to say.
Hey, Adam, this is Eric from Silicon Valley. So I've noticed something strange with Apple Pay of late. New registers, mostly at gas stations, are now requiring me to enter my, the CVV code or CCV code on the back of the card. When I tap my Apple Pay, I get, you know, the confirmation on the phone, and then the terminal comes up with, you know, enter your code. And I usually have to pull the card out and have a look at it because I don't remember what the code is. Anyway, this is a new thing. I've seen it at three different places now. And I don't know, it's just another weird new thing that Apple Pay is not quite, as easy and slick as it used to be. Anyway, love the show. Been listening for years and years. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Hey, Eric. Thanks for sending that in. Luckily, wow, that is something that I have not encountered yet, although I have a feeling I'd be very irked by that. I mean, it really does end up defeating the whole purpose of being able to use Apple Pay, right? Because the idea is we're not supposed to have our card with us, nor are we supposed to need additional security features like a zip code or signing or putting in some other number that's on the back of the card that we now have to pull out of our wallet, which now we could have just taken the card out and stuck it in the dang reader, which actually at the pump is the reader that is going to have the skimmer on it, and it's going to hack our card and steal our information and steal our identity and take away all of our security and privacy and everything else. And just, this is so frustrating to me. And it just makes me want to reiterate that I really feel, and I know because I get emails and comments every time I bring this up from people who are defending this is not being an Apple problem, but I'm going to reiterate that this is an Apple problem. Apple has a big problem. What is happening is not Apple's fault. So let me be clear about that. The fact that this is requiring the CVV2 code, it has to do, I don't know if it has to do with the reader, if it has to do with the payment processor requiring it, it's the credit card company, if it's the retailer, I don't know. I have a feeling it's just that the terminal is too dumb to know that this is not a credit card, that it's actually Apple Pay. Something in the software is not recognizing it right. And so the cause of the issue, or the cause of what's going on, is a technical one. It's something to do with the mechanics of the system or how it was set up, the software, whatever it might be. So no, that is not Apple's fault. What I'm saying, though, is that Apple has a big problem in what these user experiences end up being. They're not doing enough, I think, to change or work to change or take control of that end of the process. And a lot of people are going to say, well, they can't do anything. You know, they can't do anything. What are they supposed to do? They can't make these companies do certain things. My point is I think they can, or they can at least try to partner and work with them better so that the Apple Pay experience is as good as it can be at retail. Look, Apple has, what, $900 billion in the bank? They can spend some money to address this issue. And I'm not saying that they're not doing some things already. I'm sure that they are. I just think they need to do more. This is really a last mile problem. And they've done such a great job with every other part of this chain. They're signing up tons of banks. They're getting support from the credit card companies. They're rolling this out in more and more countries. But when we get to the register, and I recognize too that this is largely a US problem, and it's probably some of it having to do with us not being familiar with contactless payments or being kind of new to contactless payments. And yes, we need to get new hardware and terminals out there, but it needs to move faster. We've had Apple Pay for has it been 2 years now? Maybe longer, 3 years? I can't remember the exact date when it came out. But Apple needs to be working with whomever they can to get broader deployment and less friction at the terminal. We had good news in the US, I think a couple weeks ago, that Safeway is finally implementing Apple Pay. But every grocery store, in my opinion, should be accepting Apple Pay at this point. There shouldn't even be a question. There shouldn't be pushback. We shouldn't be having to still ask, do you take Apple Pay? And hear the answer, no. It should be ubiquitous. And if Apple needs to pay off retailers, if they need to do kickbacks, if they need to do incentives to retailers to get them to adopt Apple Pay, why aren't they spending that money? Why aren't they making huge investments in this? It just feels like this is a technology that they pioneered, they sold to us as the great next thing, the replacement to credit cards, and it's not realizing that promise. And I just feel like it can be. It can be the replacement to credit cards, which suck. I mean, the chips are horrible. They're so slow. They take forever. And it's such a pain in the rear. And my Apple Pay on my Apple Watch is, when it works, is beautiful. It's simple when it works like it's supposed to. But more and more, it's not working like it's supposed to. It's not ubiquitous. And until it is ubiquitous, until I can use it everywhere, until I can leave my house and leave my credit cards at home, Apple Pay, in my opinion, is not a success. It hasn't done the thing that it was born to do, that it was set out to do, that Apple, I think, wants it to do. And yes, we'll get there eventually, but I think it's just going too slow. And I think ultimately people are going to forget about it, or some other technology is going to come along and surpass it. The opportunity exists. So if this is left to languish, then it will die and be forgotten and will be a lost technology. And it just has such great promise. I love Apple Pay. And that's why I bring this up. You know, it's starting to feel, Apple Pay right now feels like the days before we had a national bank. You remember when, you wouldn't remember, none of us would remember, but if you know your history, you know that in the U.S. we had this thing where banks issued their own currency. Every bank had their own money. And so you'd travel out west and they'd be like, I'm not taking that. I don't know that bank. I don't know what's going on with that. And that's what it feels like when you go to use Apple Pay, and it's like, we don't take Apple Pay. We take some other weird thing, or, you know, Walmart Pay. That's this whole weird QR code implemented thing that Walmart does. You know, why isn't Apple Pay in every national retail chain in the United States? It should be, and it could be. And, you know, I know I'm being kind of grandiose about these ideas, but I'm trying to make the point, right? It's not like the days before national banks, really, but it does feel a little bit like that. It's like, you won't take my money. I want to give you my money. This is the format I want to give it to you in, and you're giving me resistance. And why is that happening? Why can't Apple convince retailers to do this? And I think they can. The issue is money. It comes down to money. It comes down to fees. It comes all the things that these guys are complaining about. I'm saying, Apple, make the concessions. You know, be the company that is going to give a little. And I know that's hard for Apple to do, and I know they typically don't do it, but I think if they would give a little in this regard, Apple Pay could be massive. It could be huge. It could be accepted everywhere. And I'd just like to see it happen. You know, maybe it's just too complex. I don't know. Maybe I'm being unrealistic. You let me know what you think. I love to get feedback from you on this, but, you know, this just doesn't seem like it should be that hard. So, Eric, thanks for the message. As frustrating as it is to hear that, I hope I don't encounter that same problem. Actually, frankly, I don't have a single gas station that I can go to that accepts Apple Pay. So I'm a little bit jealous that you even get to use Apple Pay at the pump, because I've been to one Chevron station, and Chevron was supposedly going to support Apple Pay. Since Apple Pay has come out, I've been to one that took it, and it was an awesome experience. It worked great. So, hope to get to use it again someday. But thanks for your message, and I look forward to anybody's feedback. But with that, that is going to do it for the show for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, and PDF Pen for iOS, and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can check out all of Smile's applications, get more information on their software by heading to smilesoftware.com/maccast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cacheFly.com, and all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send me audio comments or emails. Send those to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And finally, if you'd like to follow me online between shows, you can find me on social media at Twitter, twitter.com/maccast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/themaccast, or you can check out the MacCast Google Plus community. That's at google.com/plusMacCast. But that'll do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.